The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everybody. Welcome once again to In Perspective. I am Bob Branco. Great to be with all of you on this lovely afternoon here in New England. A little smoky this week, but I'll get to that briefly. This is episode 473, dated Friday, July 17th, 2026. And before we continue, allow me to introduce my good friend, colleague, and co-host, Peter O'Toole. Peter, what's going on today?
We're in typical summer weather in Coos Bay, Oregon, which means about 65 degrees, sunny and windy. We are very happy to have this weather until like November, and then it starts pouring rain for 6 months. So anyway, we're very happy here.
We've had a very interesting week here. We've had a lot of haze and smoke. As many of you know, there are a lot of forest fires throughout Canada and parts of Minnesota and maybe other states, and we're getting the brunt of it from time to time. It changes our weather. The sun's not coming out sometimes. The temperatures are not as warm as being predicted. And it's very eerie, and it's going to be here and there and back and forth for a little while until something is done about the forest fires. Anyway, let me thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer, and who, by the way, is our host for today's program. I'll get to that later as well. Our media sources, thank you for airing us when we do, and also Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions. Thank you for archiving our programs on my website. In order for folks to find them, they must go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcast. Click on them, and you will see most of our archives programs from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
As I said before, Raymond Gay is our host for today's program in place of ACB because of convention issues. And I do want to thank Chloe Collins from Valley Eye Radio for offering the link for our Zoom meeting for today's program. Thank you very much, Chloe, for taking the time to donate your link so that we could have a program. We appreciate that very, very much. We are here today with somebody who made history a long time ago. He was the first official weatherman from the Weather Channel. Some of you will watch the Weather Channel, I assume. I watch it from time to time on cable television. And we have with us Andre Bernier. Andre, first of all, welcome to the program. We appreciate it.
Thank you very, very much. It is a privilege to be with you today.
And I must tell the listeners and Peter as well, I first heard about Andre Bernier back in the 1970s when he was a pinch hitter for a local weatherman at a local radio station here in New Bedford. The weatherman's name was John Parisi, God rest his soul, and Andre Bernier filled in for him. At the young age, probably 18, 19, Andre, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you used to do weather forecasts in his absence.
I did. Periodically, they would ask me to pinch hit on weekdays, but my primary focus was weekends because there was no meteorologist on weekends. And at the age of 15, while I was still in high school, I absolutely insisted that they needed some weekend weather. And, at first I thought, well, he's 15 years old, pat me on the head kind of a thing. That's nice. But, we don't think so right now. I kept insisting until Dick Stevens, who did a weekend radio show, he was the DJ in the afternoon. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, why don't you stop by the station and you can do the boat and beach report at 15. And I said, there's my foot in the door. Okay. And all summer long, I showed up every single weekend and did a little 30-second boat and beach report. Now, at the end of summer, obviously, boating and beaching ends in September. And then I said, well, I'm back in school, but the weather still goes on. You still don't have a weekend weather presence. I said, let me do your weekend weather. And apparently, I must have found favor in their eyes. They said, okay, go ahead and give it a try. And they had Jim Phillips, the newscaster at the time, take me under his wing and showed me everything that I needed to do to put it together for Stan Lipp's open line program on Saturday and the Sunday morning music program. So I was on in the mornings at the top of the hour, right after the news. And at 15 years old, that was where I started. And I was there until I started college in 1977 in September. So I was there for roughly two and a half, three years or so.
When I first heard you, it would never have occurred to me that you were that young. You sounded very mature, Andre. I want to say that first and foremost. But also, you made reference to Jim Phillips. I want you to know Jim Phillips is still at WBSM today.
I understood he was maybe retired from the news part, but he is still producing a program, I think.
Yes.
On WBSM?
It's a community program. He does 1 hour of community events. I think it's called something. I can't think of it off the top of my head. It'll occur to me later. But Jim is doing that, and he does a wonderful job interviewing people in the community once a week.
Jim is fabulous, and he was so kind to me. He was in his 20s, had just graduated from a journalism school, landed the job doing weekend news and other things, too. But he extended such great kinds. Everybody there at the station did, from Stan Lipp to Jim Phillips to Jim Loomis, who was another DJ.
I knew Jim. I knew all the people you mentioned.
Yeah, there's such great, great people, and every single one of them extended some extraordinary kindness to me from somebody who just wanted to get a little experience in, and they did that and more.
By the way, the name of Jim Phillips' program is Town Square Sunday.
Okay. Yep.
So, Andre, forgive me, Andre, I think when I came on, you were talking about the blizzard of 1978.
Right.
And I of course remember that too. At the time I was in New Jersey, and we got nailed with that storm too. How did that influence your interest in the weather?
Well, at the time in 1978, I was in my first or freshman year of college, and that would be Linden State College up in northeastern Vermont. And some folks may think that that sounds familiar. Well, that's where some of the great TV weather folks from the Weather Channel came from. We were a great resource for the folks at the Weather Channel. Only because the co-founder of the Weather Channel was my professor, one of my professors at Linden State College. He went on to be the co-founder of the Weather Channel with John Coleman. So I was up in northern Vermont, and I was jealous because we only got like 2-3 inches of snow, and we were listening to all of the radio stations on Skip, AM Skip, WABC, WCBS, let's see, WINS, Winds, 1010 New York. And we were just listening, all piled in, meteorologists in the dorm room at night, listening to the gloom and doom, and we thought, we're missing it. So I was very, very jealous of my family. Of course, my family was saying it was no picnic, that It was quite a storm.
And how did that, you were obviously interested in the weather.
Yes.
Did you study that in college? Did you, you know, sort of explore how that whole thing happened? And
yeah, that was my focus in college was getting a degree in atmospheric science or meteorology. But my interest in weather goes all the way back to when I was 3 or 4 years old. And my primary language, not being English, was French. We had a very, very dense Franco-American population in New Bedford at the time, back in the 50s and 60s. And my mom and dad used to tell me a story that a friend and I, a friend who only spoke English, I spoke only French, but who cares? We are like a couple of 3 and 4 year olds playing in the mud puddle and having fun. Well, one day a thunderstorm was arriving and I got up and I pointed and I said, "Regarde les nuages noirs." And my friend looked at me, kind of cocked his head and said, "No, those are black clouds." And I said, "No, nuages noirs." And, my mom and dad wondered what we were arguing about and his mother and father. And we were saying the exact same thing, except that I was saying it in French. He was saying it in English. Ever since then, I was incessantly asking my parents, what's the temperature? What is that cloud going to do? What's the weather going to be like? And they thought it was a passing fad, but it wasn't. And yeah, it just had, I liken it to a gift from God, really, because he gave me that desire. And that was my only desire in terms of a career. That's all I ever wanted to do. And since I was 3 or 4 years old.
So you got your degree.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Well, we were all trying to scramble, trying to find our first, jobs, and either it was on or off air. There was essentially a tract for both. Those that went off air went to the National Weather Service or the Air Force or, utility companies that employ meteorologists. I was interested in television meteorology and was sending tapes all over the place. I finally got the attention of a news director in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and they flew me out for the interview. This was while I was still in school. I hadn't graduated yet. And apparently, I had been given great favor by the folks there, and they offered me a job. So I had a job waiting for me just a month or two prior to graduating. So moved to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And right now it's known as KGAN. It was known as WMT at the time, Channel 2. And it was the CBS station and was there for about a year or so. That was my entry point into commercial television meteorology.
Do you know Jim Cantore?
I do. Well, we have spoken and exchanged emails and DMs on Twitter. He went to Lyndon State College, but many years after me. So he's a little younger than I am, but we know of each other. Yes.
For those of you who don't know, Jim Cantore is a weather guru on the Weather Channel. As
right.
a matter of fact, one day he was so excited about a snowstorm that he was physically in,
mm-hmm.
and he heard a lot of thunderclaps.
Right.
And so somebody decided to songify his weather report about that, and they made a song called Thunder Snow.
Really?
And I'm going to send you the file, Andre, okay? And you're going to love it.
I'd love to see it. I'm familiar with the episode, and I believe he was in Plymouth, Massachusetts during a snowstorm, and there was thunder snow. And... Yeah, he was so excited.
It was the day after Valentine's Day, 2015.
Ah, okay. Very good.
Well, let's talk about thunder snow because, I've experienced it a couple of times, but as I understand it, fairly rare. What needs to happen? What's the difference between thunder snow and thunderstorms? And how are things different in the atmosphere, to make thunder snow work?
Well, the thunderstorm, the summertime thunderstorm develops very, very tall clouds. And the theory, and it still is a theory, they still don't exactly know how the charges build up inside the clouds. But the theory is the updrafts and downdrafts are so violent that the raindrops hit each other. And as they hit each other, electrons fly off. And so... you have a cloud which is electrified, And just like when you rub your feet on the bottom of a carpet in the winter, your fingers loaded with electrons, and you come close to a like a doorknob, which is loaded with positrons, it's going to spark. And so essentially you're looking at sparks in the cloud, which are obviously very, very powerful. Now, to have the same thing happen in a snowstorm is different. You do need the dynamics of the ocean. Typically, thunder snow occurs near the ocean, where you have a little more dynamic structure of the cloud, because snowstorms are not as tall in terms of precipitation production as thunderstorms. But the dynamics is often, under the right conditions, so charged up, no pun intended, that you get the electrical charges not in the raindrops, but in the snowflakes. And if you get enough of them stripping off the snowflakes, you have the same issue where you get essentially the finger loaded with electrons getting close to the ground and discharging, and that would be lightning. A bit more rare in the winter, but it does happen, but only in the wildest of snowstorms. You just need that little extra oomph because the clouds are not as tall as they are in summertime thunderstorms.
And like summertime thunderstorms, when you get those thunder snows, the snow comes down like crazy, right? During that portion of the snow.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, with that segment that you mentioned, where my colleague was in Plymouth, I believe the snow was coming down at the rate of like 1, 2, 3 inches per hour, which is really extraordinary. Anything half inch per hour or more is significant. 1 inch, you start getting some eyebrows raising. And, of course, you get 2 and 3 inches, and that really, really gums things up very quickly wherever it is happening.
And of course, that happens in summer thunderstorms, too, not 3 inches of rain necessarily, but you get a bunch of rain all of a sudden, and that's where floods happen, right? I mean, that's one of the ways you get these massive floods.
It's a taller cloud, right? Yeah. So you get the rain producer, the rain oven, as I like to call it, because it's essentially cooking up the precipitation we see. And the taller the thunderstorm, A, the heavier the rain, B, the better the chance of seeing hail form, because it is so cold way up in the atmosphere that the raindrops go basically up and down. It's like an ice cube factory until the ice cube gets too big to be supported by the updraft, and it just falls to the ground.
And I'm thinking about something I saw in Columbia, Missouri when I was out there, which were thunder sleet, you know, where you had these thunder sleet storms. That with temperatures 30 degrees. It wasn't snowing, but boy, it was sleeting really, really hard, and there are the usual thunderclaps.
Yeah, precipitation types are really interesting. It's not just rain. It's not just snow. It's sleet. It's grapple. We get snow pellets, different things at different temperatures, according to the temperature profile in the atmosphere. You can have all kinds of really interesting things.
So talk about the Weather Channel. How did they get started, and how did you get involved?
Well, I remember, and perhaps some of you remember, John Coleman, ABC, Good Morning America. He was Good Morning America's first meteorologist, and he did his weather from Chicago. They broke away from their New York studios and went to Chicago. John worked at WLS, the ABC affiliate in Chicago. And the story is told by John Coleman to all of us at the Weather Channel. At the time, one day, apparently big news broke, and they got into John Coleman's ear and said, "John, you only have 1 minute for weather." And he says, "That's unacceptable. I've worked all night and to produce a 3 minute weather hit, and you essentially tell me 1 minute?" And they said, "It is what it is." He got so frustrated. He said, "That's it." He said, "There, at that point, cable television and cable news outlets were beginning to pop up, CNN and SNN, Satellite News Network. And he said, you know what? I think we need a network for weather.
Mm-hmm.
So he started pitching the idea to people, investors, went all over the place, and he got a little traction. And at that point, my former college professor started working for John Coleman in Chicago as his meteorologist. And so they teamed up together. They developed a kind of a clock, if you will, a clock of what would be covered in a typical hour of weather, 24 hours a day on a cable network. And they finally got a little traction, and they got the interest of Landmark Communications in Virginia Beach. Landmark Communications was only a newspaper, but they were looking for a way to get into television, in particular a national cable network. And they thought, well, this is interesting. And they presented all of their findings, and they said, we think it's a go. And finally they said, okay, how much do you need? And they laid out everything that they needed, which was quite a bit because they had to hire 32 on-air meteorologists, to do that, as well as behind the scenes and all of the equipment that went along with it. And, they said, we'll do it. And, so, when I had heard that, I was in Cedar Rapids at the time, and my former professor gave me a call when it was time to start hiring everybody. And they said, we'd like to hire you. Are you available? And I said, well, my contract says I have a top 20 out. What that basically means is if you get an offer from a television market that was in the top 20 bracket, that you were able to let go of your contract, in my case, in Iowa. Well, I was only there for 6-7 months or so, but I said, this is a dream come true, to be on a national cable network. Yes, there were some risks because there were so many people that said that will never, ever work. 24 hours of weather, that will never work. It was the butt of many jokes on late night television with all of the late night TV hosts. I went to my TV station. I said, well, technically the Weather Channel is in a top 20 market. It was in Atlanta, even though it was not part of the Atlanta television market, but it was part of the contract. And they said, well, you're right. And I said, I'd like to go. And so they released me, and I was there on March 1st, 1981, which is when 32 on-air meteorologists and all of the background meteorologists came into this building that was still loaded with dust. It was a skeleton of a building. They had plastic chairs out, everybody. Everybody looked at each other and thought, what did we get ourselves into? Because it was a skeleton of a place. But little did we know, it was 24 hours of work on a couple months down the line. May 2nd, 1982, at 8:30 a.m. is when we went on the air. And out of 32 meteorologists, I pulled a short straw, at least one of them. There were two. The other one went to Bruce Edwards Kalinowski, who ended up in Cleveland also after leaving the Weather Channel. But he and I were the anchor team that started when they flipped the switch. And you can see that, by the way, on Google, on YouTube, just either Google or YouTube in Finder, First Minute Weather Channel. And you will see what I look like at 22 years old with big brown curly hair.
And what was it like? And well, first of all, I'll just make a comment. Another thing that got lots of laughs in the traditional network was ESPN. Same basic idea. Mm-hmm. It'll never work. And ESPN is like the Weather Channel. It's wildly successful, as we all know.
It is a staple, right?
It absolutely is.
Channel 47.
Well, that too.
On most cable stations, most cable outfits.
So you, what was it like doing weather, you know, in a brand new environment?
It was really, it was fascinating. I, of course, at 22 years old, I couldn't get enough of it because sure. It was all weather all the time. It was exactly what I wanted to do. But there were some real unique differences, on working for a national cable television, outlet that only did weather. And, the first was that we were our own directors and directors and technical, or TD, technical director. And what that essentially means is built into the anchor desk were two huge switchers. We switched our own shows. We switched the cameras we were using. We switched the graphics behind us. And that was unique. We did not need a technical director. Now we needed a master control operator to make sure the signal was going out to the cable upload, the satellite upload unit. But aside from that, we were the technical directors pushing the buttons. So early on, if you look at those videos, you see this little thing at the bottom of the screen. That was our switcher, our video switcher, and we used to switch our own shows.
So, excuse me. Pardon me. That's wildly unprofessional to sneeze on the air. Did you ever try to have to do that? Sneeze on the air?
Oh my goodness. We had a number of great bloopers that are probably floating around somewhere. We had sneezes, we had burps, we had somebody, I believe it was the guy who used to do AM weather on PBS, his name escapes me at the moment, but I used to watch him on television all the time. It was great doing weather with him. He apparently was doing a segment, was not feeling particularly great, and all of a sudden he turned white. And we thought, well, this doesn't look good. And he was doing a weather segment. He turned to the camera. He said, pardon me a moment, walked off camera and proceeded to put his head into a garbage can where he just barfed all over the place into the receptacle. But you could hear it. And we thought, that sounds like somebody who's sick. Well, it was. And that was the last that you saw from that day. He went home. So we had all kinds of things happen, crazy stuff, on the air.
So let's talk about, I mean, what I know of the Weather Channel, I'm not a regular devotee, but I watched it when there's a major weather happening, right? Mm-hmm. A major blizzard, a major hurricane, lots of, you know, the bad stuff. How did you prepare for that? How did you sort of make, because that coverage was consistent,
yeah.
Right? You didn't just do it for 5 minutes. You did it for sometimes 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 hours in a row. How did you schedule that? How did that work?
Well, fortunately, we had a great meteorology team that foresaw an event happening or the potential for an event before it happened. So it gave you a couple of days lead time. Okay, how are we going to approach this? And one of the beauties of the early Weather Channel days, which was in the early to mid 1980s, is John Coleman and my professor, Joe DeLeo, they hired the 32 meteorologists from all over the country so that we had people that had kind of an expertise in Pacific Northwest, in Southern California, in the Midwest, in the Upper Midwest, in the Great Lakes, New England, Florida, everywhere. And so wherever the hot spot would be, no pun intended, they would kind of pull those people in and saying, okay, we've got this system which will be affecting this part of the country, your neck of the woods. Let's plan on what we're going to do for it. Now, we did not have any live video or live capability at the time with live trucks yet. That was in the works. But we had interviews, phone interviews, occasionally a video feed from somewhere that we had to take via satellite because at that point the internet was not there. So there were some preparatory measures that we used, and they usually worked out pretty well, because the coverage was very well done. And Weather Channel had an interesting, motto, a little motto that they used when the logo flew in. One of the mottos was that we take weather seriously, but not ourselves. And I thought that was perfect because here we are, a bunch of 32 weather nerds, having a grand old time. But when the weather gets serious, you could not have found a more serious group of people that wanted to make sure that the audience that was being affected by it had the information that they needed.
And we sure did. We were kept updated to the fullest.
I remember a couple of storms when I was in New York City, and there was one, I believe it was around November 84, that was wild. And part of the reason it was wild, I was listening to, of course, radio at that time, WCBS, at the time, which no longer exists. And the weather, they were fabulous. But what I remember about that storm, it was sort of a 2-day event. And they totally did not expect it to happen or to be as bad as it was. The one day was just rain and the next day it was sort of a heavy mixed rain and snow that was snowing in the Long Island that paralyzed Long Island for days. The power was out and all that stuff. You know, just that, and the thing that I remember most about that storm, aside from the craziness of the weather, was that the people just weren't prepared. It came on them as a surprise. I'm sure that must have happened to you guys as well, especially earlier in your work.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
You know, weather, as we like to say, weather has the last say.
Yeah.
We may think that we have a good handle on a particular scenario, but sometimes weather surprises you, and it will do things that you simply do not expect.
You can only go by the information that's presented to you.
Right. And, of course, nowadays the information is coming faster. The grid size is getting smaller. We're getting very good at going out 7, 8, 9 days.
Or even a month at times. I've heard long-range predictions. And sometimes I believe in those and sometimes I don't. I'm like, how do they know 2 months from now what it's going to be like, you know?
They don't. I mean,
the Farmer's Almanac claims to know.
Well,
we won't go there. Other than I say, and I used to read the Farmer's Almanac because it was entertaining. And it was great entertainment. But when you look at their forecast, you will see in January, a chance of flurries anywhere between the 11th and the 17th. Well, chances are you're going to see some flurries somewhere
in there. Of course.
So, you know, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek weather forecast, but it's still fascinating to read.
So as you've talked about how the weather data got better, right? You could do more things.
Right.
And predict more accurately. How did that change the way you did your job?
Oh, my goodness. When I was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, we had the today, tonight, tomorrow forecast, and tomorrow was always included in the extended, which only went out 3 days. So, and that's as far as we could go.
Yeah.
Because anything beyond that, you were asking for trouble. But with time, the grid size got smaller, the computers got faster, and they're able to, it's kind of like a net. Envision a giant fishing net with big, big squares. Well, you're only going to catch the really big fish. All the little ones, the middle ones, they're going to go right through the net. And those are the ones that can essentially catch the atmosphere off guard and give you the surprises. Well, that net is getting smaller and smaller. We're catching more and more of the fish. Now, I don't think that net will ever be so small we'll catch everything, but the computers have gotten so fast that the accuracy of the 24-hour forecast is somewhere in the 96th percentile. That never was the case when I first got into the business. I mean, you were lucky to get 7 or 8 out of 10. Now it's 96%, and now we're able to go out with a reasonable amount of accuracy, 7 to 10 days. Beyond that, still a bit of a stretch. But, I mean, if I would have told myself in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, that, oh, we'll be seeing forecasts that go out 8 days, 9 days, and I would have thrown up my hands and say, you're crazy. That'll never happen. Well, it does with time, as we get better and the computers get faster and the net gets smaller and we're catching more and more of those little nuances that the atmosphere, tries to sneak past you.
Even though the atmosphere can still be unpredictable to the second or to the minute, right? It still happens more accurately anyway.
We're getting better, getting the smaller fish, but hey, there are still surprises in the atmosphere, and I think every meteorologist that's out there will not find it shocking or amazing that they're going to blow a forecast every now and again because of the nuances of the atmosphere. Like I said, the atmosphere has the final say.
So I live in Coos Bay, Oregon, which is the southwest coast of Oregon, and I find this microclimate absolutely fascinating. And part of the reason I find it interesting, aside from the fact that the temperatures are much narrower than they are in the rest of the country, and the weather's much more temperate, and all that stuff that I joke about on the show, it seems to be a lot harder to predict the forecast here. I mean, they'll say especially in the fall and the winter when it's the rainy season, because they'll say things like, you know, lots of rain coming, and sometimes they get it right and sometimes they don't. But part of the issue is, you know, I live sort of on the coast of Oregon. You can go 20 minutes in and it's a totally different weather system.
Oh yeah.
It's a really interesting dynamic. And I'm sure there are other, Cape Cod might be another place in sort of a similar kind of thing, but it's different here in this part of Oregon. As a guy who is an East Coast and a Midwest kind of guy, it's a different world.
Yeah.
Weather-wise.
It really is. And one of the reasons is the fact that the weather goes from west to east typically. I mean, occasionally you'll get some variations of that, but generally, west to east, everything flows west to east. Well, guess what is west of Coos Bay? There aren't any weather observation posts. It's just a lot of water.
Right.
And so, so we're having to utilize satellite, more satellite than anything else, because that's all that's out there. There are a few weather buoys, but they don't have the dense network in the land masses of the U.S. So everywhere to the east, we have an advantage because we have all this land mass to look at and all this data. But out in the ocean, well, good luck. You got a satellite image and that's about it.
That's really interesting because the weather is not, I mean, compared to say New York City where I used to live, they get it right. In more particular detail, the grittiness, right? The details. They tend to get that stuff right in New York City. They do not get it right here. And it's not that they get it totally wrong. It's not that, you know, that's sunny when it's pouring rain. It's not that dramatic, but you know, they'll say, expect a quarter inch of rain and you get a flood of 8 inches of rain. That does happen.
Yeah.
And it's really, and people are just used to it. They live with the unpredictability, but as a guy who is not used to it, it's interesting.
Mm. Now, please, you were in New York City, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember Todd Glickman from WCBS?
I do.
Yeah.
I do too.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I know who Todd Glickman is.
Sure. Todd was very instrumental at the Weather Channel, by the way.
Oh, was he?
Yeah. Behind the scenes, he developed a lot of our computer systems. And just a great meteorologist.
Yeah, he sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Well, I remember, you know, the Gordon Barnes for a while. And then,
he sounds familiar too.
Somebody else after him was really, really good too. They had a good group of, and they were, what I liked about them back then is they said, here's our best guess, but you know, there are lots of things that might happen that might make it, you know, weird. And I remember the 1978 storm in, and I was in Central Jersey at the time. And, the weather meteorologists weren't there on weekends, you know, so they had to back up. But I remember, and on a Sunday morning, the weekday weather guy showed up and said, okay, guys, we're here for a reason. There's a major storm coming. You better get ready or else.
Mm.
And that made an impression on a lot of people, including me.
Wow.
And sure, they were right. You know, I was much worse in Boston and Providence than in Central Jersey, but we got, you know, 18 inches of snow and wind and, probably a few claps of thunder too. As I remember. So that was a really, you know, interesting time. I want to talk about a little bit about what's going on today. About this climate change issue and what I'm really sort of interested, there are a couple things I'm interested in. The first thing is, hurricanes, is it accurate that hurricanes are strengthening a lot faster and more unpredictably? That's what I'm hearing. Is that true?
No.
Or to what extent is that true?
No, I've seen a number of very good, well-resourced graphs that actually show either no change over the course of the last century, or even a slight decline. And the same thing is holding true of violent tornadoes. The reason we're hearing about more of the tornadoes, well, the network, there are more and more people getting spread out over the country. Social media, you got folks with a phone snapping, oh, look, there's one. We never had that even 20 years ago. So the severity of them appears to be in a slight decline. When you talk about the climate, people think climate should be static, dead static. That's not the case. The climate has never been static. It has its ups and downs. It is driven largely, at least to our current understanding, by ocean water temperatures globally, especially in the Pacific, with El Niño, La Niña, and when it's neutral, we call it La Nada, for it's nothing.
It means nothing.
Right. We are just getting a hold of these cycles up and down. And, you know, back in the 70s, there were groups of meteorologists that were saying the ice age is coming.
Right.
And of course, one of our meteorologists who's no longer with us, his name is Dick Goddard here in Cleveland. He got pulled down to Washington DC with all the other meteorologists by the Clinton administration. And they were all on a bus together. And Dick, who was certainly more senior, said, well, where are all the meteorologists that said that we were going to be going into an ice age? And a few of them from D.C. were in the bus, and they just kind of pointed to each other. They said, well, that was us, too.
Yeah. I just want to back up a second.
Yeah. We have 15 minutes, Peter, for our participants.
I understand. But let me, as long as, since I've gotten down this road, let me give it one more shot.
Actually, real quick, that you don't have other participants right
all
now?
All right, here's what all we'll right. do.
So
right.
just keep
we'll
going,
keep going
and I'll let you know.
We'll keep going, and then if you do see a hand, let us know. We'll just keep going. Thank you, Ray. Go ahead, Peter.
So what I'm hearing, it's not so much that there are more violent storms. That's not what I'm hearing. What I'm hearing is that the storms intensify more quickly because of the warmer waters in the ocean. Are you saying that that is not accurate?
Well, certainly isn't this year, because the ocean water off of the Atlantic coast is colder than normal.
Okay.
It depends on the ocean water temperature. Now, if it's an unusually warm season where you have pools of warm water, oh yeah, sure, that will happen. Absolutely.
Well, I know here in New England, we had a very chilly spring. And I even thought to myself, all these people who think that we're going to have global warming and climate change, I wonder what they're thinking now.
Yeah, don't trade away your snowblower for a palm tree anytime soon.
So you are not a fan of sort of this global warming theory, it sounds like.
Not runaway, and certainly not human induced, because of the perpetrator is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a trace gas, underscore, trace gas. Even if you doubled carbon dioxide, doubled it, it would still be a trace gas. It's not like the atmosphere of Venus, which is just not only loaded, but the pressure is just unbearable in Venus. And runaway global warming, well, yeah, it's pretty toasty on the surface. It'll melt lead very quickly just by being there, but not here. And we're not going to double the CO2 anytime soon. So these little nuances are not going to really move the needle. What will move the needle? The sea surface ocean water temperature. And we're still trying to understand the mechanisms that drive that. We have some ideas, but that's all they are. That's the big driver, is the ocean water temperature globally, especially in the Pacific.
And, cause what is it Antarctica? It's the southern part that the glaciers seem to be melting more quicker down there or something.
The very latest is that, and I wish I could have pulled this information up. I can't substantiate it, right now and right here, but, there are parts of Antarctica that have totally recouped all of the snow and ice in about 2 or 3 years.
Interesting. Okay.
And there are places where the glaciers are growing. Greenland, one of the places where the glaciers are growing, not shrinking. Are there places where they're shrinking? Yes, there are. But it all has to do with this giant mechanism of warming and cooling using the oceans that we really don't fully understand yet. So yeah, the little nuances of the CO2, it's not something I am concerned with, even for my children or grandchildren and beyond.
So just, I'm not sure I understand this, because you're in the minority, which is perfectly fine. There are very smart people who disagree with the basic view that climate change is something we should worry about, or global warming is something that over the next, I don't know, 20 or 30 or 50 years might really be a problem. That's not the way you look at it.
Well, and when you say I am in the minority, first of all, I have to agree that the climate is not static. It's going to change. There will be up cycles. There will be down cycles. And in fact, we're probably right at the precipice here in the eastern U.S. where we're going to see a lot more in the way of colder, snowier years. This was a very good example, a good year for it here in the USA. We're going to see a lot more of that, not in total, but over the course of the next 20 or 30 years, maybe even the majority of them will be cold and snowier than normal. So yeah, there is a flux. There is movement in the climate. It's not static. But
it never has been static, right? That's the point. It's never been static. You know,
thank you for saying that. You know why? Yeah. Because in Greenland, the Greenland ice cores that they were able to drill and find out what was in the atmosphere and see the fossils. Do you know what kind of fossils they found in Greenland?
No.
What's that?
Banana trees.
Really?
Banana trees.
Yes.
Okay.
They had banana trees in Greenland. Now, how did that happen before the industrial age? So there were ups and downs.
Climate is cyclical.
Yes, it is cyclical, and we're just seeing a little piece of it. If we had lives that span thousands of years, I think we would be able to grab hold of the cycles a little better. But, you know, we're on this earth for, what, 60, 70, 80 years, maybe 100 at the best.
What are the thoughts about upcoming hurricanes this summer. The hurricane season, I think, started in June, theoretically. What are the general predictions?
In keeping up with the generalities, I know that El Nino was developing into a super El Nino.
Yeah, that's what I saw too.
Yeah, and now whenever that happens, typically the Atlantic balances out. It cools off, and it has cooled off. It's cooler than normal, so the result will be fewer than normal hurricanes in the Atlantic, and that has so far proven to be the case. So far, we've had a few interesting systems, but it's not been voluminous by any stretch.
There was one hurricane, I think, Arthur, ended up in Texas.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and that was in the Gulf. That was not even in the Atlantic per se. That was in the Gulf of America, I might add.
Gulf of Mexico, for us.
for those that remember it as the Gulf of Mexico, right.
And that's another conversation.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation. Yeah. So you would think that hurricanes not only will be less number, you know, fewer of them, but they will be less, you can't predict this, but they're likely to be less ferocious.
Yes. This year in the Atlantic, you know, we can only go year to year based on what the water temperatures are doing. But when we saw the El Nino, the super El Nino developing, we thought this could be a really quiet season in the Atlantic. So we'll see what happens.
What about the Pacific off of California and, you know, Washington, Oregon?
Probably be an increase, but of course you're affected by the Alaska Current.
Correct.
Which keeps the water temperatures pretty cold. So the chances of a hurricane.
We don't get hurricanes here.
No.
What I was curious about is sort of the amount of rain. Cause you know, this year we didn't quite get enough rain. We need more rain, during the rainy season. And so I'm just curious what the general thought is about, if you know, what might happen in, you know, next week, winter or two.
And that's the key, because you said winter, and that is essentially the focus on rainfall for the Oregon and Washington coast. It's, where the ocean water temperatures, anomalies are, and can it produce that little focus stream, we call it the Pineapple Express, essentially where all the moisture starts in Hawaii and is taken by the jet stream and just pulled right into Washington and Oregon State with continuous storms every 3 days or so, or even shorter. So that's going to be an interesting play. I'm not an expert when it comes to the Pacific Northwest. But I would assume with the super El Nino that dependent on what happens in the Gulf of Alaska with that water temperature pattern, that you could be looking at some rains that try at least to make up some of the deficit that the Oregon coast has seen.
It would sure help us if it were to happen. While we're talking about this, what is an atmospheric river?
It's essentially, there are some really good tools out there that help you to visualize this. But if you look at the satellite imagery, especially in the winter, you'll see these ribbons of clouds and moisture. And if the jet stream is just right, these rivers are really difficult to dislodge and to move around. They're essentially rivers of moisture, that have their origins in the Pacific. And of course, with the so much ocean out there, there is plenty of precipitation that can be wrung out of the atmosphere simply because you got a ton of water there. So under the right condition, if you look at that river, the ribbon of clouds, which can be very persistent, that is that quote unquote river of rain that moves into the Northwest.
And some days, sometimes it takes days to stop. As I said before, I find it really interesting that they really can't predict the amount of rain we're going to get. You know, sometimes they say an inch or two and we get a tenth of an inch. Sometimes they say a few showers and we get 3 inches of rain.
Right.
Andre, do you think that the vast forest fires in Canada and Minnesota and in other spots have to do with North America being excessively dry as a whole this season, or is it something else?
Good question. And it could be a combination of things really happening. But I found it very interesting. It wasn't this year. I haven't really kept track of it, but I think it was a year or two ago when we had a similar occurrence in the Northeast, New York State.
About 3 years ago.
Yeah. If you looked at the satellite imagery in and the IR, where the IR is infrared, if you look at the IR, all of a sudden you see these little pockets suddenly blow up. And they, first of all, they happened in clear skies. There was no lightning. And they all just kind of spontaneously all happened at the same time. And there were maybe a dozen all at the same time. That's weird. I mean, a lot of strange things in the atmosphere, a lot of strange things that we've yet to discover, but that's just plain old bizarre. How does that happen? I'd love to know. And I can't offer even a hint as to what was going on there or why the fires are going on where they're going on northeast of Minnesota. Same thing. Sky's mostly clear. There weren't any lightning strikes to fire off those, or at least in some cases. So there's a lot we don't understand. And maybe management is a part of the issue. We're getting better and hopefully putting that knowledge to use at managing old growth, because old growth needs to be cleared out periodically. And nature did it beautifully back in the early 1900s, 1800s. There were more firefighters. I was showing my wife a graph, who's a meteorologist, by the way, a graph that showed back in roughly 1900 to about 1915, there were 10 times as many wildfires as there are now. But we're, you know, the population is growing. Regulations don't cause a lot of this growth to be managed well. And the old growth just sits there. It's like a tinderbox. And yeah, it doesn't take much to get a fire going and then to propagate it into this huge affair. So hopefully we'll learn from it, get better at forest management, and get rid of the old growth like nature did it in the 1900s when it wasn't a problem. It was small little fires, but they were voluminous.
As I remember, the Native Americans got really good at this.
Yeah.
You know, and we should be, you know, we should be better at it, I guess.
We are about to wrap it up. Just in 30 seconds, Andre, what are you doing today?
I am on the radio every day, a local radio station in Barberton, Ohio, right here from this studio. And I do it 6 days a week. My wife, again, also a meteorologist, she does the seventh day. She does part of the weekends. And so I'm still involved, yeah, in weather. Still writing books periodically. I got one coming out in September called The Wonder of Up.
We'll have to talk about it on the program someday.
Yeah, we should bring you back early next year.
Absolutely. Oh, okay. We'll talk about it.
Okay.
And I want to thank you, Andre Bernier, first weather person to be on the Weather Channel. And I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us today, and we'll have you back in the future. So thanks again. We appreciate you.
A real, real privilege. Thank you so much for asking. And I had a great time, and I hope we can do it again.
Let's hope for the best.
Okay.
All right. Peter, thank you, of course. Ray, thanks for being our host, and thanks to everybody else. And Chloe, thanks for giving us the link. This is Bob Branco. Go safe with God's abundant blessings, and have a great week, everybody.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
When someone you know is struggling with vision loss, it can be challenging. But the Mass Commission for the Blind is here to help. We'll connect them to resources that will help them plan for the future with new skills and assistive technology. Find out if they're eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.